Welcome to Beneath Your Beautiful, where guests share stories of adversity and perseverance, which inspire, encourage, and challenge us. We embrace these tough conversations, intimately exploring our loves, fears, and hopes with a delicious combination of depth and lightness.
Hi, my name is Kari. I'm a research associate for Cedars-Sinai, and I was born in Chonburi, Thailand, and I live in Southern California now.
Oh, you were born in Thailand?
Mm-hmm.
Are you Thai?
I'm half Thai, half Vietnamese. I was adopted to very white people. Oh. So I grew up eating white food and kind of immersed in white people culture, which often made it difficult as an Asian American because I lived in a very white community. It was very difficult growing up. I got bullied a lot.
Oh, you did? What did they bully you about?
You know, it was the stupidest things when I was a kid. They'd make fun of my nose, you know, like what was 7-year-olds, right? They're just like, you're a flat nose talker. And I was like, what does that even mean? And they're like, you have a flat nose and you talk a lot. And that was my nickname for like 3 years.
I just photographed the Salish conference and it was so beautiful in the fact that they had community and heritage. So is that what you felt like you were missing?
Definitely. I definitely missed out on like eating Asian food even. I mean, it wasn't until I was an adult that I really tried sushi and pho and real ramen, you know, not from the package. And that was such a life-changing thing for me. I remember I dated this boy and he took me out to sushi and I'd never had it before other than the grocery store sushi in high school, right? And I felt like I was doing something wrong, you know, like I was like, like I had to hide it, you know, I felt like it was against my culture because I grew up basically being a white person. So I feel very white in culture and to, you know, eat something so Asian, so very, very Asian, it felt wrong. It felt like I was betraying my family in a sense, which is interesting because it's just a food. But I think it was the overall experience of being immersed in an Asian culture, kind of like a restaurant with Asian sounds and smells and language, you know.
Are you trying to recapture that? And are you upset with your adoptive parents about that?
I'm not upset with them. They raised me how they would raise their own kids, which is totally acceptable and reasonable and expected. I think, you know, we could have branched out a little more, but at the same time, that's no different than if I had grown up in Asia and never had a hamburger, you know, or have French fries. Like I would probably be like, oh, why didn't we ever try this before? This is delicious. And so now I eat mostly Asian food. I very much gravitate towards Asian cultures and things, but there's a big Asian community here in Southern California, and I still don't feel like I belong. You know, I'll go to the boba tea meetups and ramen meetups, and I still feel like I'm the odd one out, you know.
Why do you think that is?
I think I feel left out because I don't understand all the lingo. I didn't grow up with my mom making me rice soup in the morning. So they'll talk about these things and they'll talk about like, oh yeah, when we went back to China. And I'm like, I didn't have that experience. You know, I went back to Thailand on my own and then convinced my family to go with me. And we all did. And it was a really nice experience. And I've been back to Thailand many times, but I still feel like I belong in like a white farmer town, you know, and I tend to date white farmer boys.
That's funny. So in your life, has that hampered you at all in real life, not just as a kid or being bullied in school?
It has changed some opportunities for me. My name is, you know, Kari Thatch. It could be Asian. It could be white. Like, never know. And then the last name is very close to a Vietnamese name. So a lot of people think that I'm not adopted. So I have to explain every single time I meet people that I'm adopted. That's why I don't speak Vietnamese or Thai, you know, and like, my Thai is okay. I can get around, but it's not conversational as if I had grown up with it, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm very grateful for the life that I have and the things I have and just the way that I was raised. I think I was raised with good morals and values in general. So I have no complaints. It's just different.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm just really attuned to it at the moment because I was just at this event where there were, you know, young kids to elders really embracing their culture. And I actually felt so jealous because there's nothing like that that I have. I mean, I like that there's meetups that, you know, people are trying to connect.
And, you know, my mom tried really hard when we were younger. She'd make pad thai, a famous noodle dish, on our birthday every year. And we'd bring out the Thai decorations. And for Christmas, we have a Thai dinner and we bring out, you know, the little figurines that I've broken over the years and all those things. And we do that. But I mean, I always look forward to that. That's my favorite family get together is Christmas Day, eating Thai food, and my birthday going home for pad Thai. You know, they're like core memories for me, even though it's just food.
Their whole movie's about how important food is, and especially, you know, if it's cultural. So it does make total sense that that's something you gravitate towards. Were you adopted out of an orphanage, or how did the adoption happen?
I was in two orphanages. I was born in Chonburi, Thailand, and I was in an orphanage, and then I was moved to Bangkok, Thailand, and stayed at the Red Cross Hospital, but they have a little children's home there. It's real nice. And it's interesting. I've been back many times to visit, and it definitely gives you the feels because you can feel like the energy of the people and how they take care of the babies. And It's always fun playing with little kids, you know, but there's always like that sadness where I'm like, oh, some of these kids will never have a home, you know, and how grateful I am for that. But it's still difficult going back sometimes because there's part of me that's like, am I going to see my parents? Am I going to meet my real mom? Am I going to fit in with these people? Oh, this person looks like me. Is that my dad? You know, and those are like very real thoughts that you don't think of. The average person wouldn't think that when they go to Thailand. But for me, it's like, it's my country. It's my space. It's my home. But it's not at the same time.
Yeah. So do you know your biological parents?
No.
And there's no way to know?
I mean, it would take a lot of research and a lot of in-depth trying to find them. But I think at this point in my life, I don't need that. I have parents. I have a good family, good support system in general. And I don't see the need to add on to that in any way or take away from it.
That's really beautiful. I think it's such a beautiful thing when somebody adopts. And so that's really cool that they did
that. It is difficult though with the interracial adoption because I have a good friend. She's Black. She was one of my students when I was a youth pastor. And she has white parents. And I know she struggled with some of the things, even though she came from Las Vegas. She's not even international. There was no culture change really. And she was a baby. But I know she struggled growing up and her sister struggled with just being alive, you know, just basic things. You have this disconnect, this non-attachment, I guess, to your parents, even though they're there, they're loving you, they're feeding you, they're taking care of you, they're comforting you. But you still have this disconnect of like, they're not my real parents. And that's very difficult. And that's hard to explain to someone that hasn't been there, you know?
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
I think it's hard as a kid in general, knowing where you fit in. Am I loved? Am I loved enough? And then to have that on top of it is extra hard.
Yeah. For me, I ended up wanting to be better and always doing something better and more and greater. I haven't quite figured it out, but I think some of it does stem to like, oh, I'm not good enough, therefore I won't be loved.
Right.
So there's that internal like mentality of like, oh, I did something wrong as a baby, therefore I was thrown away. And that's not the case. That's 100% not. It's not my fault. It's nothing I did. I didn't come out and terrorize people. But that's still deep in your head of like,
right.
It's in the subconscious. Like if I'm not good enough, I'm not welcome. I'm not accepted. I'm not loved. My family will go away. My friends will go away. So I constantly try to achieve more. And I finally, this last year, kind of had to stop and be like, okay, enough's enough. Like just live for me, not live for everyone else.
That's a hard place to finally get to, but good because you were enough from the very moment you were born. It's not a reflection on you, what happened.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice you would give to somebody going through it as a young kid?
That's so hard because there is no answer for one person or one type of situation. I don't even know if I figured it out yet, to be honest. I still have to like think about what would I have done differently? What would my parents have done differently? Was there anything that could have been done differently? Or is it all internal emotions, you know, that you can't change? I feel like maybe if I had grown up in a more Asian community, like still adopted to my same family, but in an Asian community where I had the Asian foods and stuff, I don't know if that would make it better, if that would make it worse, if that would make me sad. I don't know because I grew up in a little small farm town. So that's all I know. And I feel like my parents did the best they could. You know, they put me through counseling and therapy. And they were doing the best, all they knew, you know, how to control my behavior and how to control my emotions, which I didn't even know how to do at 7 years old.
Right.
And so to have someone come in and be like, okay, now you're going to do this, you're going to talk about this, you're going to feel these things, it was too much for me, I think. But I definitely recommend some sort of therapy for young people going through my situation, but it has to be the right kind. And it has to be, you have to be comfortable. I mean, I have a therapist now and I absolutely love her. It's very comforting to talk to her. I feel better. You know, we talk through hard stuff, but it's on my terms, you know. I think as a child, I felt forced into admitting things or saying things that I don't feel at that time, or couldn't even process the emotion. You know, they told me, oh, you're doing this because you're angry at your biological mom, your birth mom. And I didn't understand that. I could not grasp that understanding until much later in my life.
Yeah.
So it led to a lot of destructive behaviors, a lot of acting out in school. And like, some of that's because, you know, I'm on the spectrum. So I did have trouble in school, like sitting still and processing directions and fitting in. And so there was all these components going on at once. And I'm sure my parents were like, what do we do? Like, put her in sports.
And so did you play sports?
I did. I played soccer from the time I was 5 up till college. And then I did swimming. I hate the water. I hate getting wet. I hate showers. But my mom was like, oh, you know, you're going to learn how to swim, because they didn't want me drowning somewhere. You know, I would scream in the bathtub. So they put me in swim lessons, and then I slowly excelled. And then I think I was like between 7 and 10, I joined the local swim team, the Stingrays.
Oh, funny.
And swam for them. And then I swam all through high school. And then I did the master's team in college.
Oh, you did? So, but do you still hate getting wet?
I hate it. Like, I'll take a bath. That's it. But I hate showers. I hate the water pressure. I hate getting in the pool. Like, when I go to a hot tub with my friends, I'll just, like, you know, put my legs in. So I still am like, ugh. Like, you know, I like the idea of swimming and I'm good at swimming, but I don't want to actually do it.
That's funny.
I chose ballet later. And I continue with that. I still dance ballet. And that's been my one thing that I'm like, I can do this. I can handle this. Like, this is fun.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Where do you dance ballet?
I dance the Nutcracker with San Diego Ballet every year.
Oh, wow.
Before that, I was in a small company up in here in Temecula. And we performed at the local theater and did shows. And it'd be, you know, 2-3 weekends of shows every 6 months. It was a lot of work. But it's something that I can express and I feel confident in, and I feel included. And it is a struggle. There are really hard parts of it mentally and physically, yes, but mentally, the mental aspect of ballet, I think, is the most challenging for people. And that's why a lot of people end up kind of messed up afterwards, because of the mental game.
Well, for somebody who doesn't know what you're talking about, what does that mean? What is the mental game of ballet?
There's a big push and drive to be a perfect body type and have a certain amount of pirouettes and a certain turnout and a certain way of doing things. Just, they have something to say about everything. And I got to dance in Russia, and that was really exciting. But it was very intense. You know, this lady had a needle on the end of her stick and she was poking you, and like,
oh, wow.
It was terrifying. And like, they just yell at you and you have no idea what you did wrong, but you just know you're being yelled at. And constantly being told you're too fat, your breasts are too big, your butt's too big, your legs are too thick, like every day. And even now, San Diego Ballet is really good. But, you know, I definitely don't look like everybody there. And I'm small, I'm 106 pounds. But for ballet terms, that's not small enough. I've seen a lot of my friends have trouble with like amphetamine usage, coffee usage, chocolate, you know, just like binge and fasting and anorexia. You see a lot of those problems in the ballet world. They made many movies about that experience that kind of capture it. And it's very real. Like Black Swan, although it's a little bit over the top, it is very real, the emotions that that girl goes through. And there's been a couple other movies that are the same where it's like, yeah, that's totally how it is. And it's like, once you get in it, it's so hard to get out, you know?
But you do that. You do that for fun.
Yeah. I love it. There's something about the applause at the end of the show and people coming to see, oh, my friends all come to see me every year. And it's like exciting because they're just like, oh, Kari's in the Nutcracker. We're going to go. And I get really excited to see my friends in the crowd and or afterwards, you know, and get flowers, and just hearing the people really appreciate your hard work is so addicting. It's great.
Thank you. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you want to talk about?
I have a mini pig.
You... What is a mini pig? Is it a little tiny pig?
Yeah, he's a small potbelly pig. His name's Oliver. He's going to be 6 this Saturday. We're having a birthday party for him.
Where is he?
He's outside.
You have a little yard for him?
Yeah, he stays in the yard. He comes inside sometimes. He's very lovely, very smart. Pigs are very smart.
Well, what inspired you to have a mini pig?
I was looking for a dog on Craigslist. And
somebody tricked you?
Yeah, I found a pig, and it was a picture of him with his belly in the snow. Aww. This is the cutest thing ever. So I emailed them, and I was living in Bahrain at the time. I was working on a health team over there. And I said to them, I was like, I'm not going to be home for 3 more months. Can you hold him for me? And they did. They held him. And then I came home, and he came to my yard. And it was a great experience. I love having a pig. It's just so weird. It's so different. You know, people are like, what, a pig? I'm like, yeah. Like, nobody gets mad about him, you know, making noise in the backyard.
Well, does he make a lot of noises?
He grunts a little bit. And then if he's really upset, he'll scream. Like when it's raining, he'll scream outside the door and just scream and scream and scream. And I have to like go talk to him and be like, so he's like a toddler. You know, you got to be like, I understand you're upset, but we don't scream. That's not nice. You're a rude pig. And then he'll like go and hide in his house for a little bit. Like he understands. It's so weird. He hunts for bugs, digs up my dirt, diminishes my property value, that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, Oliver.
It's tough, though, because when I was working in the Middle East, I'd have to leave him for 6 months at a time and then trying to coordinate someone to take care of him for that time. And that was very difficult.
Because they don't have like doggy daycare. There's no piggy daycare.
No, they have places like pig sanctuaries and stuff. They're expensive. It's like $100 a day. You know, so I pay the little neighbor girl and she comes over and feeds the pig. And I got her enough money to actually, she went to horse camp 1 year. And I was like, did I really give you that much money? Like, geez, I gotta start traveling.
Again, oh, Oliver.
Oh, Oliver.
Oliver.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cute. That's really cute. Well, you're so cute. Thanks for having this conversation with me.
Of course, anytime. I'd love to talk more. You're very easy to talk to.
Do you have any words of wisdom or rules you live by?
I live by the term radical acceptance, which I learned that in DBT. It's now called CBT therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. And I did DBT and CBT for years. And the one thing that I really took away from that was radical acceptance. And that's accepting what you cannot change.
Yeah.
And that is very difficult because it's not just accepting, but it's radically accepting. Like, yes, your coffee pot breaks in the morning. You're like, yes, it broke. And be okay with that. Not just like, but really accept everything. I mean, someone took my debit card last week and I just had to be like, all right, get a new one, file a report, you know, do all the stuff. But I've really learned to be much calmer and I don't feel anger. I'm very much mellow about most things and everything seems to be okay. You know, I don't have a lot of problems just by practicing radical acceptance.
We do go through hard things. And also, though, every hard thing I've ever gone through, I've come out the other side of it. And I have to remember that. Thanks for reminding me to be that. And also, somebody reminded me yesterday to question everything. I don't know why I forgot that, but I was saying something and she's like, is it true? And I was like, oh, probably not.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Beneath Your Beautiful, hosted by Hara Allison. And thank you for your ratings and reviews. We'll be back next week with a new episode. Stay tuned.